Our last speaker for today is Rod Buckland. He's the founder of the first space school in the UK. Today he'll be talking about his thoughts on who would make the best Mars trip astronaut.
Okay, hello. I'm fairly fresh off a long aeroplane ride from the United Kingdom, but I'm reasonably fit and well. Just suffering a little bit from cold showers this morning, but maybe that kept me awake. What I want to do in about 20-25 minutes, to give you some time for questions, is to introduce you to some thought processes about who would make the ideal astronaut for a mission to Mars. In fact, to follow the robotic explorers that Ed Stone has just been talking about. And I also want to slightly mischievously take you through some of the thought processes that might lead us to say when this will happen, the first manned mission to Mars, or I should say personed mission, shouldn't I? I mustn't be sexist. Okay, so what I'll do, first of all, I just want to explain my background, because it'll explain some of the rather outrageous things that I say. I'm not completely new to Australia. I went to school in England, and an Australian university decided to give me a scholarship to study in Australia. So I did my first degree at the University of Western Australia, and I still remember the place with great happiness. When I graduated, I was extremely lucky when I was at University of Western Australia. It was at the time when there were major new space activities taking place. Even when I was a second-year university student, I was lucky enough to be employed by NASA during the summer holidays to assist in the first link-up in space, Gemini 6 and Gemini 7. And I really am this old. That was 1965. So this is a good way to start a career in space. Get a job when you're at university in the space industry, if you possibly can. Now, for the last 20-30 years, that's not been very easy in Australia, but I think now there are some very interesting things happen, both at government level and in commercial senses. I think you probably had a lecture from Kistler Aerospace today. I would rate the opportunities in Australia now being very, very good indeed. Another thing I did when I was at university during the long summer vacation, you know, November to February, was get a scholarship to Mount Stromlo. Now, I thought, this is very nice. They're going to give me a scholarship. What a fantastic honour. But in fact, it was their way of saying, well, come and work for us for 3 months and we won't give you any salary. So, and what I did is I pointed the biggest telescope in the southern hemisphere for all these astronomers coming down to Australia to observe what only can be observed from the south. Now, my first ever full-time job, I started 3 days after I graduated, and it was in Woomera at the Deep Space Network Station, DSIF-41 it was called in those days, and we were tracking robotic explorers launched by JPL for NASA in the late 60s and 70s. That dish, very sadly, was taken down and used for scrap iron. It's a very sad story. Next slide, I think, will show you the sort of spacecraft that we were tracking. Yes, that's one of these robotic explorers sent by JPL in the good old days, late 60s, early 70s. The first missions to Mars, of course, were flybys, and lots of other exciting missions were done. Having spent 2 or 3 years in Woomera, I don't know whether you remember what Woomera was like in those days. It was a town of 5,000 people. There were about 1,000 families, which accounted for about 4,000 people altogether, you know, husband, wife, children, 2.2 children each or something. There were 967 single blokes, and there were 3 single girls. So after a couple of years in Woomera, I was beginning to think that, you know, I really can't stay here for the rest of my career. But I did participate in the first landing on the moon. Although we were tracking robotic spacecraft, we were allowed to switch over to the Apollo landings during those very exciting times. Just a typical example of what they did towards the end of those lunar missions. And isn't it sad that America went all the way to the moon, took up that challenge from President Kennedy in 1962-63, and really never did much more than plant the flag and do a bit of publicity. No real science. And of course, we haven't been back to the moon since in any meaningful manner, apart from the recent Clementine and similar missions. And the next slide will take you on to one further step in my life history. Yes, this is Christmas 1968, and I would just want to throw this at you as being the start of a ever-increasing awareness by members of the public, and especially enthusiasts like you, of what a fragile home we live on. This is Earthrise, seen from the moon, Christmas 1968, by the Apollo astronauts who did a figure of eight round the moon and came back to Earth. I think that's a seminal moment in history, seeing the Earth in that black, inky sky and realizing that we are in a very fragile ecosystem and we're messing it up as fast as we can go. Next slide. This rather surprises you, doesn't it? Having spent 2.5 years in Woomera, I decided to really get back into the mainstream again, so I signed on for an Antarctic expedition. And my job, believe it or not, was counting penguins. Right, next slide. We won't dwell on these things. I just want to sort of give you a picture of... And that's one of my most proud moments, is driving dog teams across the Antarctic sea, the sea ice. You can't do that anymore. All the dogs had to be RTA'd, returned to Australia. And today's expeditioners live in... they got satellite television, and they've got hot and cold water, and they don't have dogs. They've got snowmobiles and all these other crazy things. We basically used to scorn mechanical aids, mainly because the Antarctic Division couldn't afford them. They are every hour we had to rest the dogs for 5 minutes. I always think that's a very nice picture. Sums up lots of things that I've learned about since in management. Rest your staff every hour. Yes. Right. Okay. Now onto these things. So I reckon in about 10, 15 years' time, in the Melbourne Age, on the Saturday, you know, all those big executive jobs, you're going to see an advert like this. Mars Geological Survey. Expeditioners wanted. No experience necessary, you see. And today's school leavers are going to be about the right sort of age to be thinking, hey, this could be something for me. So, who is going to be the ideal astronaut for a mission to Mars? Now, I'm going to be very, very controversial here. I'll probably get lots of people having a go at me. I'm going to propose, in fact, that females are better oriented towards long-term space missions like going to Mars than males. So here's one dimension. On the way to Mars and back, I think probably Ed Stone may have told you that it's going to take about 9 months to get there, 9 months to get back, and you can spend about 6 months on the surface, and you don't have much choice about that because of the orbit dynamics involved of the planets. So you're going to be outside the Earth's atmosphere. Mars atmosphere is no good because it's so thin. You're going to be outside the Earth's atmosphere, outside a shield of radiation for, 2.5 years, say. Two and a half years. So radiation is going to be a big problem. Now, I want to propose that women, in fact, are much less susceptible to X-ray radiation, gamma-ray radiation, all those nasty radiations that you find when you're touring around the solar system. And it so turns out that women, in fact, are less susceptible to these radiation, to damage from radiation. And as every girl knows, it's not the total amount of fat that matters, it's how it's distributed. And it so turns out that the female physiology is such that the fat that you do have tends to protect the most vital organs. I can assure you that is a very, very well-based medical story. Now, it turns out, of course, that in missions to Mars, 9 months there, 9 months back, you're going to have to put up with zero G, or very clearly, or very nearly that, unless we have some very complicated spinning spacecraft, but I think that's quite unlikely. And it can be argued that women are more susceptible to osteoporosis. I think it's probably the same in Australia as it is in Europe, that more women suffer from osteoporosis than men do. Now, osteoporosis is this, this brittle bone type effect. But you can always put off the arrival of osteoporosis by lots and lots of exercise. So really, having zero gravity and not, you know, not being able to sort of go for your jog every morning doesn't really have to be a problem. What you need to do is take your bike with you and just, you know, take the wheels off. Do lots of exercise every day on the way to Mars and on the way back, and osteoporosis will not afflict these marvellous women astronauts that we're hoping to select. And the same sort of arguments go for muscular atrophy, the wasting away of the muscles in zero G because they're not being exercised. And it also applies to cardiovascular deconditioning, the general, because the heart doesn't have to pump blood against gravity, it weakens to a certain extent. All those sorts of effects, which certainly the first two tend to affect women more than men, can be more than compensated for by regular exercise each day at one end of this railway carriage sized spaceship. And of course, generally, I'd have to say that women are more healthy than men. I actually went to see my doctor last week. Won't tell you why. And that's the first time I've been to the doctor for 22 years. The doctor didn't believe it when he saw my record. You know, good Lord, is it really possible that you haven't been to see me for 22 years? It's typical men, isn't it? Eh? Women look after themselves a lot better than men do. And generally, well, they live longer and tend to be healthier than men. Right, so there we are. There's a very quick run through why I think women would make very good astronauts on long-term missions to Mars. Now, there is another category of criteria that we have to judge these things by. That was the physiological characteristics. Now I'd go on to the psychological characteristics. And I think those are the four key items in this criteria: isolation, confinement, monotony, and stress. Now, the reason why I showed you the Antarctic pictures is because I spent, you know, 12 months at Mawson with 23 men. And in the middle of winter, when it was dark all day, we had some very interesting, stressful times being 23 men. Nowadays, the Australian Antarctic Division is so much more enlightened. They have women on all the expeditions. And I have it on good authority that all the men are much better behaved and everything is a lot less stressful. So I think there's a good argument here. You might think that the first mission to Mars would be an all-male crew, you know, all these test pilots. No, we need a good number of women on the first expedition to reduce the stresses and the monotony. I don't know about the isolation so much. I don't think you can do much about that. But there was a paper written for a medical journal some time ago which said that women are actually more capable of putting up with isolation than men. Knowing my daughter's phone bill, I can't quite understand that. But there we are. Now, so we're supporting the theory that women should make up the first members of the first team. Now, I'm going to propose, in fact, that perhaps this is going just a wee bit too far, but if you're going to be in zero gravity for nine months and then spend, you know, 6 months on the surface of Mars in 1/6 gravity and then spend another 9 months coming back, I mean, there is an argument that says, really, you know, your legs are a bit redundant. So what I thought maybe is that we should propose female legless astronauts, but not legless in the normal sense of the word, at least not in Australia anyway. But the point, no, seriously, Lucy, no legs means less body mass, which means that you're going to be using up less oxygen, less food and less water. And one of the big problems on the first missions to Mars, when we finally get round to doing it, will be, of course, that we're going to be severely stretched in providing those three resources for the astronauts. You know, there's no refueling stop on the way. There are some interesting ideas about possible use of Martian resources when you get there, but who wants to depend on being able to do that on the first mission? Maybe not too many people. So I do mischievously suggest perhaps legless is an interesting attribute to have. If you have legs already, you might have to cut them off. Okay, so female legless. It's the same argument, you see. The less the body weight, the less the oxygen, less food, less water you need. A normal Australian male, I'm told, uses 8.1 litres of oxygen per square metre per hour. That's presumably when you're not running, swimming, winning Olympic medals and things, but that's normal sort of, you know, everyday catching the tram. And clearly, that's per square metre. So you see, if you can reduce the amount of square metres of body surface, then you can reduce the total amount of resources that you need to get there. And in fact, on a two-year mission, average male would be using 250,000 litres of oxygen, which is a lot of oxygen. And there's no oxygen when you get to the other end. So you've got to take it all with you. So there are arguments for sending pygmies, you see. Or should we say small outsized people? Right. Well, put those together. What have we got? The ideal astronaut is a female legless pygmy with a good education. The good education, I think, is pretty obvious, yeah? If you want to be an astronaut for Mars, get yourself a BEng BSc, just like Cindy did, is in the process of doing, from Monash. You want to be multi-skilled in a lot of different skills. I think engineering and science would be a good basis. Probably don't need too many historians for the first mission to Mars. But what are the, you know, that might be the nominal titles of the six crew members that go on the first mission. I mean, they might be slightly different, but those would be the sorts of categories of people. But the important thing is, and I come back to my Antarctic experience again here, is that you must be able to do more than one of those jobs. You can't just have six people with six specialities. Everybody has to be able to do at least one of the others, preferably more. You notice I haven't put the word cook in there. Now, in Mawson, we had a cook, and we used to take turns on Sundays, giving the cook a day off. And with 23 of us, of course, one could expect in 46 weeks to be go around twice. Well, it's one of the great sadnesses in my life that when it came to my turn to be cook on Sunday, I did my job. They never invited me again. So there we are. Now, so there we are. Female legless pygmy with a good education. Hope you're convinced.